Call the meeting to order. I'll invite Troop 121 from St. Thomas More Newman Center to come forward. As the troop comes forward to lead us in the Pledge of Allegiance, I invite everybody to stand and to offer a two-minute moment of silence for the memory and service of firefighter Lieutenant Bruce Britt. Please join Troop 121 in the Pledge of Allegiance.
I pledge allegiance to the United States of America, the Republic for which it stands.
Thank you. Please call the roll.
Mr. Thomas?
Here.
Ms. Nauzer? Ms. Hoppe?
Here.
Mr. McDavid?
Here.
Mr. Schmidt?
Here.
Mr. Trapp?
Here.
Mr. Scala?
Here.
We have minutes from the council meeting of February 17, 2014. Are there any corrections to the minutes? If not, may I have a motion and a second to approve?
So moved.
May I have a second?
Second.
All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed say nay. What corrections do we have to the agenda? Mr. Trapp?
Mayor, I'd like to move R-3014 from the consent agenda. I can never tell if they're new business or old business.
That will move to old business or
new business.
Okay. Public Works Director has requested that remove 3914 from new business since no building permit has been issued. The street closure is not necessary. Are there any other?
So you're removing that from the agenda, correct?
That's what was the request. Is that okay? Yes, that's what will be removed from the agenda. May I have a motion and a second to approve the agenda as amended?
So moved.
Second.
All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed say nay. Welcome to the meeting. We offer several opportunities for public comment during the meeting, during the public hearing section, old business, new business. And there is an open comment section at the end of the meeting. Each individual is entitled to 3 minutes. So I'll ask you to respect the timer that's directly in front of me. If you represent an organization or a group that's directly involved in the issue, you may ask for, and we will yield 5 minutes. We'll move to item A. Please read item A.
Agenda item A is the construction of upgrades to Boiler 8 at the municipal power plant to reduce nitrogen oxide emissions.
Staff, please.
The Columbia Municipal Power Plant currently has four operating units at this time. Boiler Turbine Unit 5 has been operating since 1956. The Combustion Turbine Unit Number 6 has been operating since 1963. Boiler Turbine Unit Number 7 has been operating since 1965. And Boiler Turbine Unit Number 8 has been operating since 1970. This project that we're here to discuss tonight is the project for upgrade of Boiler Turbine Number 8. This unit is the latest generation addition to the power plant and is the natural gas operating boiler turbine for the plant. This project will position this boiler turbine, number 8, to be compliant with upcoming emission regulations and modify the plant's operating permit to change its low exempt usage status. This project is covered under electric CIP item EL-183 in this year's budget with a beginning funding allocation in this year's budget of $1 million of the projected $2.5 million for this project that it's estimated to cost. This project will be phased. Phase one is in the accompanying resolution 38-14 requesting for the authorization of the $365,000 for engineering services with SEGA to start this project. This phase will support the permitting process, which must be done on a plant-wide basis. It will also perform the design for the equipment specifications for this project, and it will provide the construction design and support. The future phases for this project that will be required is the procurement of the equipment and the construction contract are future steps in this process. We did conduct an IP meeting on this in January, and we did not receive any negative comments for this project. This project will allow for the continued operation of our most recent addition to the Columbia Municipal Power Plant, Boiler Turbine Number 8, with a lower emission rate and greater operational flexibility as an outcome of this project. The Water and Light Advisory Board has reviewed and recommended for approval of this project. So with that, to answer any questions about this.
Council, questions?
I just had a few questions. This is gas boiler 8 that
yes,
we're
it
talking
is.
About. And in the past, we've been, I think, have been proceeding with some evaluation of boilers 6 and 7. 7
correct.
With regard to biomass.
Correct.
And 6 with regard to what? I mean, is
same thing. Those are two solid fuel units. So we're getting ready to come forward with a plan that's going to include any potential to go with biomass and really what's the long term future of those units as they pertain to their existing design with coal.
And some of this is driven by the fact that natural gas prices have gone down and coal is so and you're retrofitting for some of the noxious
yeah.
elements.
That is one of the drivers is our IRP shows that the price of natural gas is going to be a viable fuel for some time in the future going forward. This unit was designed for natural gas, but it also has some of the older emission equipment on it, so we need to put some low NOx burners so we can get the NOx rate down to meet the emissions standards that are coming. There's a number of environmental regulations that are going to be coming in the next few years, and we need to get this boiler situated so we can continue with the operation inside the new regs.
And I think I understand some of the nuances between capacity and load and so on and so forth, but it always amazes me when I hear this number, and maybe just to throw it out there, but is it really true that the municipal plant, in terms of its power generation, is only really responsible for about 6 to 7% of the electricity need?
Right.
In the
from an energy perspective, that's about
not from a capacity,
right.
but from an
not
energy.
From a capacity.
It always seems like a very low number to me, but nonetheless.
And even at this time, anytime you're dealing with a natural gas resource, it typically carries a lot more of the capacity requirements and less of the energy requirements.
Yeah, thank you.
This is something that can be fired up and turned off much more easily than coal, right? The reason I ask that is we have an emphasis on renewable energy, and we never know when the wind is going to blow in Iowa. And so when the wind is blowing in Iowa, we may not need the natural gas, but on a hot, still, sultry August night, we might need it.
Yes, but this is a little bit more of a lower heat rate, a little longer startup time because it is a steam-driven turbine, so it is a boiler-driven as opposed to a combustion turbine, which is what those units are that will start in like an hour. This will probably take at least 3 or 4 hours, and the coal units take a little bit more than that. But it's more along the design of the solid fire units with a steam turbine as opposed to a combustion turbine.
But you do know 3 or 4 hours before the sun sets?
Yes.
All right.
And really, all the operational parameters are driven by MISO. I mean, we tell them how much it's going to cost and when it's available, and they tell us when it's going to run.
Okay. Any other questions? I'll open up to the public. Would anyone from the public like to speak?
Monta Wilts, 2808 Greenbrier Drive, on behalf of People's Visioning and 10 at least organizations involved with us and many other members of the public at large, so maybe I could request the 5 minutes, if it would be permissible. The public at large, at least many of them, did not hear about the February 3rd interested parties meeting on upgrades at the municipal power plant to Boiler 8, burning only natural gas, estimated cost at $2.5 million. But the question that we have is the $365,000 for engineering services, which is over a one-third million more included in the $2.5 million. If not, the total estimated costs rise to nearly $3 million of public funds. Also considering the last part of the very last point and conclusions from the Burns and McDonald's 2013 assessment, this is an ill-advised investment with insufficient public stakeholder upfront input. Boiler 8 does not have a high historical use rate. This with the above and various other notes from Burns and Mac, including that distributed solar needs attention and is not very attractive to utility companies focused on their money from rates, which they've become accustomed to, which explains how the public is in the position of driving the renewable train to increase cost-effective renewables, benefiting, albeit differently, the entire community. Burns and Mac point out, as People's Visioning has in our proposals for solar, with solutions to this objection, that there will be associated costs as the public goes solar, and go they will, which is a goal and point of People's Visioning Renewable Energy Plan for All. We have publicly requested this PV REPA on more than one occasion in 2013 and again tonight as important to discussions on energy for peak and base load not supplied yet by cleaner, less costly mixes of renewable via distributed generation on individual homes and appropriate neighborhood solar locations across the entire community, benefiting all income strata that are now able to go renewable with the PV REPA. Burns and Mac note prices of solar are near parity with dirtier energy sources, more costly in reality than their prices reflect, as seen with the rash of health and environmental pollution events. People's Visioning, Interfaith Care for Creation, and Columbia Climate Change Coalition have repeatedly pointed to these emissions. As validated in Burns and Mac, we continue to point out the rise in natural gas prices as health detriments and environmental impacts become more obvious. Recent research from MU indicates strong caution is needed regarding extreme extraction techniques enabling lower, in the moment, incomplete and inconclusive cost prices and assessments of natural gas from horizontal hydraulic fracturing. Burns and Mac also validate our strong caution against going forward with cost decisions on natural gas, omitting or discounting these factors in the day our national glut, keeping prices artificially low, is shifted to global markets. This is 3 minutes. Do I have the 2 minutes?
No, your time has expired. Thank you very much. Anyone else?
My name is Diane Meeker, and I live at 2401 West Broadway, apartment 1120, and I'm speaking on behalf of Columbia Area Now. And I want to ask you to vote no if you vote tonight on this proposal, because of the process, the public was given almost no input on this, and there's been a lot of recent and very strong public opposition to using the compressed natural gas in the first place for the heavy-duty fleet, buses, and other city vehicles. And we're asking that you help drive costs down enabling our community to become our own power suppliers and stop spending public money in ways that send this money to purchase dirty power out of our own utility users' pockets, out of the community and our regional economies. I will say that Columbia Area Now very strongly supports People's Visioning's plan for renewable energy for all, and also the Plan B, which is an alternative to the TIF, which is also supported by Burns and McDonald in numerous areas, including improvements on commercial building codes as left out of recent code upgrades. Our own City Hall commercial addition attests to doability and ease of installation and construction on local commercial builders. We're asking for urgently needed code upgrades immediately, in addition to focusing away from natural gas and towards renewable energy for sustainable development. Thank you.
Anyone else?
Eugene Elkin, 3406 Rangeline. I'm merely wanting to make a comment of update. We're all, of course, opposed to the natural gas usage, but under the University of Missouri, as I've told you, I have different ones that work inside the place. I would like for some of you to follow up with what I'm about to say. They currently are using wood chips and mixing that with coal. As you go forward with each and every endeavor for the city, we need percentages. Are they at 50% of one and 50 of the other? I'm not sure. They have built a special structure, and if you're traveling north on Providence and look to your right, you'll see a set of array, what are solar panels. Those are now driving the lights for this new facility that is the place of dumping the wood. So I found it quite interesting that what little facts I learned, that some things are failing as we go forward. Each thing is an experiment to save the future cost of utilities. Thank you.
Anyone else? I'm going to close the public hearing. I'll start. You know, 50% of Americans heat their homes with natural gas. I wish I was one of them, as I looked at my last utility bill. But the two least expensive forms of energy over the next 5 years are going to be wind and natural gas, and they complement each other very well. I mean, we have a we're going to be buying more wind energy, I presume. That's about the only way that you're going to get bump up to 3%. And as solar becomes cheaper and more useful, this is going to complement that too, because obviously the problem we have is our peak usage is some July and August, when it's 8:45 at night and it's 98 degrees and there's no wind. And so this 35 megawatts of capacity, I presume, that's probably when it'll be turned on and be most useful, because people, you know, we've chosen as a society not to live at 100 degrees. So I'm going to enthusiastically endorse this proposal.
Just a few things. One is, I want to remind folks that we've taken a pretty aggressive stand on renewables, even very recently, to increase the renewables portfolio that we have, probably much to the chagrin of some of the staff, in terms of how we have decided to adopt a more aggressive approach towards renewables. This also gets into the capacity argument that we have, because solar and wind are not conducive to the kind of capacities that we need to ensure that we have dependable electricity. I'd also like to suggest that we're talking really here about only one of three other boilers. Two of the other boilers are being retrofitted, I guess, for biomass. This one will be natural gas, and it is a relatively small component of our output, not so much capacity, but of the power generation rather. And the other part of this equation is, in addition to our power needs, we have taken a pretty aggressive approach on this city council in terms of international building codes and the improvements and the efficiencies that accrue there too, particularly with residential, and I suspect sometime in the future we'll probably consider some of the alignments with some of the commercial responsibilities as well. As for the process, I can remember talking about boiler number 8 several years ago when I was on the council the first time. We were considering some of the evaluation then. Seems like it's taken a long time, but I suspect that some of this has been in the public arena at least for a couple of years, not necessarily this latest boiler, but this boiler did have, as I understand it, an interested parties meeting to discuss this issue, and it was advertised the way it was supposed to have been. So for all of those reasons, and for the reasons of diversification of our power and our capacity needs, I'm prepared to support this.
Anyone else?
Without prior consulting Carl Scala, he pretty much stated what I was going to state, that we have increased our renewable energy goals. I personally contacted the Water and Light Board to see how they felt about this in terms of the total picture, and they were, I think, unanimously on board. I think they're a really strong board for wanting to do renewable energy as much as possible, so I think it's a matter of a reasonable balance, and so this will improve this particular steam boiler with the combination that we have right now, so I'm comfortable voting for it also.
I would just quickly add on top of everything that was already said that I'm in total agreement with, that we have a large wind contract on first reads that we'll be voting on next meeting. So we are moving aggressively towards renewables. There is capacity issues where we need to have this, and it's going to make the air cleaner when we reduce our nitrogen oxide from what we're currently doing. I plan on voting for.
And I will support what Carl, Barbara, and Michael said. We need to keep a focus on increasing the percentage of our energy usage that comes from renewable sources and conserving, reducing our energy usage. But that should happen at the higher policy level, and I think that this is a needed improvement.
If there's no one else, please call the roll.
This is one that takes a motion.
May I have a motion to proceed with plans and specifications? Is that okay?
So moved.
Second.
All in favor say aye.
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 Opposed say nay. Resolution 3814 dovetails first one, but you can just summarize it again.
Yeah, this is
simply. I need to read it first for the record. R-3814 is a resolution authorizing an agreement for professional engineering services with SEGA Incorporated for the Boiler 8 Nitrogen Oxide Reduction Project at the Municipal Power Plant.
Steph.
This is the Phase 1 contract to begin the engineering design, and to answer a question was put before you earlier, yes, the contract to this is included in our total estimate.
Any other questions? Would anyone from the public like to speak? Council comments? Please call the roll.
Council Bill 3814, Mr. Thomas?
Yes.
Ms. Hoppe?
Yes.
Mr. McDavid?
Yes.
Mr. Schmidt?
Yes.
Mr. Trapp?
Yes.
Mr. Scala?
Yes.
3014 is under new business or old business?
New business.
All right. Please, we'll move to consent agenda. Please read the bills.
Items on the consent agenda include bills 4214, 4314, 4414, and resolutions 3114, 3214, 3314, 3414, 3514, 3614, and 3714.
Please call a roll.
Bills 4214, 4314, 4414, and resolutions 3114, 3214, 3314, 3414, 3514, 3614, and 3714. Mr. Thomas?
Yes.
Ms. Hoppe?
Yes.
Mr. McDavid?
Yes.
Mr. Schmidt?
Yes.
Mr. Trapp?
Yes.
Mr. Scala?
Yes, on all bills and resolutions.
We'll move to a new business. Please read R30-14.
Council Bill 3014 is a resolution declaring the necessity for construction of Phase 1 park improvements on property located at 801 North Strawn Road, stating the nature of and the estimate of the cost of the improvement, providing for payment for the improvement, providing for compliance with the prevailing wage law, and setting a public hearing.
Staff, please.
Yes, thank you, Mayor. This project is a redevelopment of the former Southwest treatment facility that the department exchanged with Public Works many years ago. It's 129-acre tract of land. We're proposing to do a phase one development of a disc golf course, a neighborhood park, and some creating some soccer fields. I believe Councilman Trapp had some questions about connection to the Bellwood subdivision, and I'd like to just kind of highlight what we're looking at here. This is a plat of the Bellwood subdivision right now. This phase one is in, which kind of pretty much runs like that. This part to the west is not developed yet. There is a trail easement. I can blow that up right there, right here. It's a 20-foot easement. There's already a home sitting right there. And as you can see from the topography there, it's nearly impossible for us to get an ADA connection using that 20-foot easement down to it. So we don't think this would be a great access for the development for that neighborhood to get to the park. Now, the next phase that's being platted does show another 20-foot easement here, but this is a preliminary plat. It has not been submitted. We'd like to work with the developers on this about maybe moving that easement to this side or in a better location so that we could get down there. This is a little better grade than the other area, but it's still not perfect. It still does not allow us to you know, just go straight down the hill. We'd have to serpentine down the hill to get it to tie into that. If you look at this phase two, it would be right about here, and this is the area where we're proposing to develop all of our neighborhood park facilities, the playground, the picnic shelter, restroom, parking lot. That's where we're proposing to have all that. We don't have the funds in phase one to do that at this time just because of the length of the road that we'd have to build from Strawn Road all the way to the back of this area here. So that's why we're proposing that this part of the development would be occurring in our second phase or in our funding in our next ballot issue, perhaps. And then that way it would give us time to work with developers on the second phase of Bellwood so we can get that trail connection to that neighborhood. So if you have any questions, I'm available to answer them at this time.
Well, you answered my main question. Maybe John Glasscock could ask, is there sidewalks coming on Strawn Road to give access that way? I had to come up with a question for you because he had already preempted my question.
And that's a MoDOT route. It's Route ZZ, and so we don't have any sidewalk projects along Strawn Road at this time.
Oh, okay. That makes sense. Well, that was easy. Thanks.
Mike, I have a question for you. Could you go back to the slide where you showed the first, the one before that? Oh, no. Forward again. That one.
Okay.
So there is an easement drawn in the plat, but you don't, it's not really a usable easement.
Right. In fact, this house right here on the corner in this triangle is former councilperson Jason Thornhill's residence right there. And where they sited the house, it's kind of right closer to this east edge. So we have to put the trail right almost, you know, within 10 feet of his actual house.
So all of these houses on this cul-de-sac have been built, have they?
All of them but this one, the one right next to his. And that's owned by, I thought at first maybe one of these houses owned it, but it's there's three individual property owners right there.
So my question really is there an opportunity to build a trail connection from the street west to the common land between the two streets, or is it too late?
It's really pretty steep. You know, I think that's why it's not been developed. If you went out there and looked at it, it's a really steep grade. It'd be tough.
I meant to the, I think, the west side.
Oh, going this way on the other side? Well, there's houses all along here.
And so
these are all developed.
Too late to negotiate something like that.
Right. And the lots, you can tell there's not much room there. We wouldn't want to do that, especially when we have the option just coming back in here later on. I think
right,
we have a much...
That wouldn't help people on that other street. They'll have to kind of go all the way around to then get
unfortunately,
into the
that's,
park.
That's correct.
Any other questions? Would anyone from the public like to speak? Council discussion?
This, in spite of the lack of connection with the Bellwood, this is a lot of park for $125,000. You guys really, and you've brought in a championship level this golf course, which has been something that I've been rumbling about. So I think that, and I love the partnership with planning to pursue with Convention and Visitors Bureau, because, you know, those kinds of sports championships are going to fill hotel rooms and bring people into the area. And disc golf's a pretty popular sport. It's, you know, gets out. And it's a different kind of demographic than hits a lot of sports. So I think it's kind of important to have that entry level into physical activity, you know, for people who aren't going to join a baseball league or that kind of, you know, team sports kinds of stuff. So I think it's going to be a nice addition to the park system, and I'm very, very pleased with that.
Please call the roll.
Council Bill 3014, Mr. Thomas?
Yes.
Ms. Hoppe?
Yes.
Mr. McDavid?
Yes.
Mr. Schmidt?
Yes.
Mr. Trapp?
Yes.
Mr. Scala?
Yes.
Introduction and first reading. Please read the bills.
All bills are introduced by the mayor unless otherwise indicated. Bills 4514, 4614, 4714, 4814, 4914, 5014, 5114, 5214, 5214, 5314, 5514, 5514, 5614, 5714, 5814, 5914, and 6014, first reading.
We'll move to the first report, 19-14. Which is an update on an ordinance to allow accessory dwelling units. So, staff.
Council, an ordinance has been prepared by the Planning and Zoning Commission, working with the staff. They've had a number of work session meetings working on this and refining it. In between, there's been some public input meetings that the staff have organized, and the general public's had an opportunity to comment on the concept and the drafts that have been available at those stages. That's in the last 2 months that's been done. And so the purpose of the report tonight is really just to check in with council, show you what is now the Planning and Zoning Commission's recommended draft ordinance, but also report to you some of the feedback that we've received. It's mixed. And it tends to follow geographic areas. For example, the neighborhood associations located northeast and east of downtown, the Benton Stevens and East Campus, generally speaking, have been more negative toward the concept. There's a feeling that there's issues of overdevelopment or excess of park vehicles and building coverages in those neighborhoods, whereas North Central and to the west, more favorable comments. And we've also presented some information just so you can show, just to show that what the impact of the ordinance might be. That's the what's referred to as the eligible lots map. The staff did an inventory of lots that if you made these certain changes to the ordinance, these are the lots that, due to their current use and dimensions, would allow an accessory dwelling unit to potentially be sited there. An accessory dwelling unit is one that's, by definition, it's a second dwelling on a single family lot. It's not an additional dwelling for a duplex or any kind of multifamily structure. It's restricted to single family lots, but it would be, for instance, a cottage residence that is going to be smaller and must be smaller than the so-called principal residence. Could also be an addition to that that house that is, again, subordinate or smaller in height and area and extent than the original residence. We're also giving some options should you want to give some direction at this point to the commission. This would still have to go through the formal public hearing process, as all zoning ordinance changes do, where the commission would convene a public hearing with public notice, and we'd publish the draft ordinance, and then they would take additional testimony and make a report to you with the ordinance for your consideration.
Let me start by saying that I think we're going to have to be extraordinarily careful about implementing this, and I'm going to strongly recommend that we choose a pilot area, a confined overlay area. And the experiences, you know, I still remember a request for rezoning on Bushell from R2 to R3. It would have allowed one more student And East Campus wanted to protect their zoning, wanted to protect their density, and it was a very contentious public hearing, and we voted that down 4-3, and I was a swing vote. And once again, I had some people that wouldn't talk to me for a while after that, which is customary. But the point I'm making here is that adding this sounds like student housing. You know, in your neighbor builds a small, you know, 20 by 20 foot building and puts two or three students in it. And I think that it's going to have a very limited role in the city of Columbia. There may be some areas, I think Mr. Schmidt has talked about some areas that he thinks would be amenable to this, or maybe even it'd be an advantage. So I think we need to be very careful in picking a pilot area or a very confined overlay to roll this out.
I agree with the idea of a pilot area, and there has been, you know, some fairly significant opposition to this idea. But it's not my impression that it's limited to students, this kind of expansion of dwelling types. Could you maybe comment, Tim, on other communities that have introduced ordinances like this and how that has affected development?
Yeah, I think, first of all, it's what I'd call traditional neighborhood development. Before there were zoning ordinances, people devised solutions
all the time
in the urban environment, and one of those was to build a small cottage-scale house. Maybe it's a story or story-and-a-half residence that's in the back of a lot. Typically, it might have alley access, might have a long driveway to the rear access, and it might, you know, It may have served as residence for domestics. It may have served as residence for additional family. It may have served as a source of second income, in which case any tenant that would be acceptable to the owner-occupant of the home would have lived there. So, you know, I think that's the spirit of this ordinance, is provide a housing option that's not not the mass-produced type of housing, but it's something that's based on an individual's decision to make a little more out of the house that they inhabit and open it up to a renter or perhaps a family member. There's examples of persons that have used this type of housing to house relatives who need some independence but may not be capable of living completely independently of their family. There's examples of individuals that just want to have that one or two tenants so that they have that additional source of income. And there's those that do it because they know it's a more affordable option. If it the main residence is a 1,000-square-foot home, which is rather small to begin with, this code would require the ordinance to be smaller still than that, so you might have a 700-square-foot cottage that provided the building technology is affordable, could be an affordable residence for a generation or so of tenants. So,
thanks for that. And I think I've read that it is an important tool to enable senior citizens to remain in their own homes, to be able to generate some rental income to help pay property taxes and living expenses whilst on a fixed and limited income themselves, which is good for neighborhoods.
Go ahead.
No, I'm done.
Okay. If, as I understand it, we can either restrict it to an area, or instead of having overlays that prevent it from some areas, just have an overlay that would allow it in the areas that are amenable to it. Am I correct in that?
Yeah, one of the options that's suggested in the staff memo is that you could, either by excluding it from existing overlay districts, and we have those two overlay districts, and those are areas where there are concerns about excessive development, you can take that approach and just say it will not be part of those R2 districts where there are overlay ordinances, or you could define an altogether new area.
I feel
this sort of pilot area for it.
I feel like that's the safer approach in that we don't run the risk of any unintended consequences in areas that don't want this or where this isn't appropriate, whereas there are areas that do want this and the neighbors do feel it's appropriate, and I think that would be the way to go, and it might address some of Bob's concerns.
Just a question, and that you've kind of answered, and then a comment. The question has to do with the interaction between the overlay, the conservation overlay, particularly in Benton Stevens, because I've gotten a lot of feedback about this, and you made a couple of suggestions, one of which you could exclude the ADUs from the R3 district, and there aren't many left in order to deal with that, or you could completely exclude these from any urban conservation districts. So those are two possibilities, I take it. Mm-hmm. And I'm inclined to agree with the mayor to some degree. If we want to go ahead with any of this, we probably ought to have some sort of a pilot program. And I know that, you know, there are three constituent groups that I can think about. That is the Benton Stevens group who has lobbied me, and I believe that probably East Campus, and you can speak for yourself, has lobbied Barbara and Fred's group, which are generally kind of supportive of this. I've been around this for a long time, for about a couple of years now. This, the Adrian Stalwick, I believe was her name, gave a presentation to the Environment and Energy Commission when I was chair of that group, and then that went on to the Planning and Zoning Commission when I was there, but not there to hear her presentation again. But the perception out there, at least from my constituents in Benton Stevens, is not that this is what they sometimes refer to as a granny pod, which is what you were talking about, having someone stay in their own home and so on, but this is an opportunity for rental property, that this is a commercial, is that even though rental is not necessarily commercial, it's still residential, but on a large scale, that's the perception, and that's, I think, the source of a lot of the resistance, and that's why I think we would need to move very carefully, and from my perspective, in the Benton Stevens area, this would not be something I could support.
Right, in terms of, I agree with the mayor and the other council members. East Campus has an overlay. It is also a historic district and has some unique density problems that they're addressing already. So this would just add a lot of difficulties on top of that. So I think East Campus has an overlay and it should be excluded. I like the idea of a pilot project where it's wanted and most appropriate, like the West Ash. And then we also have two ordinances and before us. One is the alternative draft ordinance by the City Law Department, and I like features of that, and there's comments by staff to P&Z that for the R2, following the City Law Department's ordinance, it will allow the accessory dwelling units but won't unreasonably increase the density to really twice what is allowed now for R2 or up to the R3 density. So it seems like the alternative draft of the City Law Department for R2 is a good one. So at a minimum, I think I like that one. I would promote that one. And at a minimum, I think both should go forward unless the rest of council agrees on just the alternative legal department recommendation.
So as a report,
so what is your read of our consensus? Just so I can figure it out.
A more geographically restricted area, so those areas where it is maybe a more favored concept, and then give some consideration to maybe not dialing up the density quite so much. Right now, R2 requires a 10,000 square foot lot if it's a two-family residence. It's a two-family district. However, in this amendment, we do allow a single family on a 5,000 square foot lot. In this Planning and Zoning Commission amendment would allow that second accessory dwelling on a lot as small as 5,000 square feet. So there you're down to 2,500 square feet per family. So it is increasing the density. The idea is it's an inducement. You can't do a duplex on that. You can't do two single-family houses on that, but you could do a cottage residence or a small addition that's a self-contained residence. That was kind of the idea here, that if we're going to encourage people to do it, give sort of a density bonus on it, and recognize this is going to be an incremental process. I don't think you're going to get a developer that would identify a number of lots in bulk and then try to build out these things. I think it's going to be an individual lot owner's decision on their own schedule. And the advocates for the concept really wanted regulations that facilitated it and didn't put folks through any kind of major ringer to get it done. There are parking requirements and dimensional requirements, so not every lot is going to be suitable if it's that minimum 5,000 square foot size. Yeah.
The other thing is, since the areas that are interested in this are already R2, duplexes can be built, and what this allows is additional types of housing that are more favored by the neighbors. An example would be the tiny house movement. Another example, other examples have been mentioned. So in other words, it's not necessarily allowing a greater density than would already be allowed on many of these lots.
I would be careful of a pilot, because I don't think we're going to see a whole lot of them, from what you said, Mr. Teddy, about that, you know, it's not going to be developers, it's going to be individual property owners, and a pilot's not going to give us much to look at, because I don't think we're going to see a lot of activity on this. I think if we just tailor it to the neighborhoods that are open to the process, that I think that's enough of a limitation on it. I like the idea of increasing density. That's a way to do it, to diversify our housing stock, make it a more interesting community. I'd love to see some little tiny houses popping up. They're a lot more energy efficient. So I think there's good things that come along with that. But, you know, obviously some folks in Benton Stevens and a lot of folks in East Campus have issues, and I don't think we should impose it upon them.
And if there's a lot of students moving to those areas, too, that kind of answers the question about folks being apprehensive about a lot of student rental. If it's already an area that's sought out by students, I would see no reason that these.
Tim, throughout this process, have people approached you that are planning to take advantage of an ordinance like this if and when it's passed?
Well, Mr. Scala mentioned the architect who's been actually assisting not only the EEC, but the Planning and Zoning Commission with some concepts. Apart from that, I think...
Is that Adrian Stolwick?
Right. And apart from that, there's been some neighbors that have indicated they would like to try it, but whether they're working with a builder and have done, you know, serious homework on that, I can't say.
Okay.
I can't say I've been approached by anybody who says I really want to build, you know, one of these. Ordinance going to be finished, but well, there you do see them in a number of communities, especially where, you know, markets take off and neighborhoods are considered. Folks will start doing these to help.
And there's another project that Mr. Amir Ziv has been promoting for a number of years. Just explain the relevance of, if there is one, between that project and this ordinance.
That's a cottage development, which I'd say is just a little different concept. It's all of the units are cottage scale, meaning they're story and a half and smaller. But they're all single-family residences. The concept there was three on Ridgeway. And typically those are clustered, so it's an alternative to house yard, house yard, house yard. It's three houses or maybe four houses around a common
one
green
yard.
Space, so you kind of make the most of the green space you have. It, you know, it's doing doing more with less in a way.
Any other comments?
Well, just to clarify, so could you come forward with alternative A and B, so then we have the choice in keeping the legal staff's alternative in the mix?
come forward, meaning back to council before?
Oh, no.
Is notice up for public hearing, or?
Or move it forward.
Move it forward to public hearing.
With the two alternates, yeah.
For consideration. Okay, we can do that.
Thank you very much. We'll move to report 20-14, which is a report on the Lyon Street Private Common Collector.
Mr. Alonji was in last council meeting, and you asked for a follow-up on this, Mayor. And so what he was talking about is 403, which is right here. This is the private common collector that comes down to this public main. As you see, there's a public main on A Street already in front of the house. All they have to do is reroute the lateral out to the main. And so really it's not a private common collector problem so much that the main's already there. And so all he has to do is reroute his lateral. The other situation where he talked about down on the 300 block, which this is a private common collector, and he did bring in a petition for this private common collector to be put on the list as elimination. So we did receive that February 27th from him, and so we'll be moving forward with that.
Any questions regarding report 20? Thank you. 21 is the annual report of the Citizens Police Review Board. It is informational, and I'll be interested to see what thoughts my fellow council members have. Just as a very superficial view of how well the Citizens Police Review Board is doing, this is one of those boards that, by my reckoning, it's sort of like being an official in a basketball game. When they're really doing a really good job, you don't even know they're there. And this has been a very non-contentious year. I think they're doing a fabulous job. I think the fact that there were only seven appeals to deal with reflects largely on the culture of the Culinary Police Department in general and community relations with the general. So it's my analysis of this that the role of the Citizens Police Review Board has been very successful over the years, and it's accomplished a lot of what the former council, I guess you were on the council, right? I would be interested in your comment on it. It seems to me that it's accomplished a lot of what you sought.
You know, I wish the council was as effective at reducing some of the controversy and some of these issues as that board was. Yeah, there was very early on, there was lots of controversy and lots of issues, even whether to take subpoena power and all kinds of other kinds of things. And I think they have stepped back from that. They've even taken the cameras out so that it can be a little bit more conducive to the kinds of decision-making and confidentiality that's necessary to protect anybody who comes forward here. But I commend that group and there has been a turnover as well. They've also taken advantage of some of the professional development, which I think was very important. And now they have one of the representatives who represents NACOL in terms of. So it's a very professional group that's accomplished quite a bit with, as the mayor suggests, not much controversy, which is a good thing for our community. And I commend them. I'm also looking forward to the suggestions that they made at the end of this report and their conclusions with their board design mediation program. And I'm kind of looking forward to seeing how that eventually gets unrolled and effectively put into place. So.
Yeah, and I was on council when we got that established, and they're doing an excellent job, and so they should continue to do what they're doing. I think the training has been very helpful for them also, so it's working smoothly, and that's exactly what we want.
Any other comments?
Well, I agree with what's been said, and I really like your analogy with the basketball official. You watch basketball, and there is a collision, and the play stops, and you have to have a lot of technical knowledge to figure out whether that was a blocking foul or a charge.
It's unlike hockey, by the way. Hockey isn't quite that way. But.
I Can't help myself. I do need to say, you know, the direction that council gave to staff was loud and clear at that time, and was really embraced by the police department itself as well. The chief and the command staff introduced unconditional respect as a foundational core value, and I think I see the results of that on a fairly frequent basis, and I think it's had an impact on 7 appeals.
As a matter of fact, I can remember when the chief, that was in the midst of the hiring process, and he was just about ready to come on board, and one of the things that he did say was that he would embrace this concept if the community wanted it. So.
And again, I'll pitch this because I think it's good for the community, but we have a 35-year low in violent crime rate in the city of Columbia, and a lot of people deserve credit for that. And so any other comments? In that case, we'll move to Report 22, which is a report on interdepartmental transfer of funds. Are there any questions? If not, we'll move to general comments. I'll yield 3 minutes to anyone from the public who wants to speak about anything.
To Wells, 2808 Greenbrier Drive. Speaking on behalf of a lot of folks in the community, many of whom were here at the end of summer talking about how they did not want to see our community expanding to compressed natural gas. We recently held an educational community meeting, hosted the lead researcher from MU who recently came out with a study about the chemicals used in this process, the hydraulic fracturing process, and more studies are showing us that it's extremely bad for public health. I know that when we entered the agreement with Pickens with Clean Energy, not everyone on the council voted for it, and so we appreciate that, and we feel like the information going forward is going to just show us that that is a direction that we would be better off taking a different way. The last two sentences of the Burns and McDonnell conclusions to their report of 2013 are what we were referring to earlier that indicate if we do have a strong move to renewable energy that People's Visioning has been pushing for, that the steps towards natural gas would be less and less needed, that we would use the MISO as a storage and we would need some of the other base and peak load responses that we generally would need. So I do understand that the Water and Light Advisory Board has apparently agreed to, you know, recommend this, but we do have a certain amount of natural gas we have to buy now, as the contract states with the Pickens and Clean Energy, and so we're not sure if that, you know, has something to do with this decision as well. But we really would like to see an even stronger push to renewables because we feel like that is the solution. And I know that we feel like we've made big strides, and indeed we have. It's just that the circumstances call for more, so we'd like to urge you to keep pushing in that direction, and we'll just deal with what we do collectively together when we get to that point. Thank you.
Thank you. Anybody else?
Eugene Elkin, 3406 Rangeline. I just am really glad to see that City Council may come to a halt early this evening, for councilmen all need rest as well as the public. This discussion of Rep 1914, accessory dwellings, I want you all to know from personal opinion, I'm very, very, very in favor of this concept. If you go around on the first ward, you'll see that Columbia was once built with what we call the mother-in-law's house. We have a tremendous load of baby boomers coming on, and we need that relative on site. So when I look at this, say mother-in-law has now passed on, what do we do with that piece of property? Someone said rental. I have an issue that I'm constantly working on, and that's called the homeless. As Michael Trapp knows, these would be beautiful settings for the homeless to move into and get on their feet. In that effort, we need a good bus line very close to these, where we established this area to be. It also requires good outdoor lighting, and that's throughout the city. We need good outdoor lighting. I was able to see, anyone can see this in the first ward, but I was able to see our first straw house off Stewart this past summer. I did not know that Columbia, Missouri had a straw house, and I found it quite interesting because tonight we are talking about renewables, and that is one more chance to use the subject straw housing. This is what I call, again, the word mother-in-law's house. It's a beautiful cottage in behind the main house. The situation of the firefighter, I thank you very much for the two-minute pause. I've said before that my family brought the Boone County Fire Protection District here in the 1970s, and as a result, I went to the site on Sunday after the accident to discover more detail of what had happened and to say I was at the fire department Friday evening just before the accident. I was reporting a situation of smelling natural gas. Here we are back to the subject natural gas. We know there's explosions throughout our world. There's a lot of things we can't help, but every chance we can pull the plug on natural gas, we do need to. I am yet to follow up to see if it was looked into. I again was there last Friday night. The situation, after having visited the site, the story I received was the ice melt has destroyed the functionability of the structure. In other words, you have a large frame, I-frame of steel that supports the concrete sidewalk outside the building. The ice melt would come off, travel down the concrete, and eat any supporting steel underneath. It was built in the 1950s. It's very possible this is happening all over the city of Columbia. I just went to report another situation just like that this past Friday.
Thank you, Mr. Hawken. Anyone else?
Good evening. My name is Peter Bogger. I live at 1411 Pratt Street in the Benton Stevens neighborhood. And that's the same Benton Stevens community declared a few years back by a national blog as the best collegiate neighborhood in the country. That's the same Benton Stevens community with the fastest real estate appreciation in Boone County. It's also the same Benton Stevens community recently forced to fight off an attempt by the Columbia city government to gerrymander it into extinction. That's the same Benton Stevens community which most recently had its legal overlay contract violated by a builder contractor who colluded with the city government of Columbia to get away with it. Ours is the same Benton Stevens community respected statewide as the most consistently progressive precinct, 3D, in the state of Missouri. See, I'm here before you this evening to stand up for the integrity of our neighborhood, our community, and our contract with you through the overlay, which took 5 years of painstaking efforts by the well-meaning neighbors as a model for the citizens of Columbia and a roadmap for our living standards. Perhaps this auxiliary unit directive task would be worthwhile for those property owners who have legitimate needs, but I assure you it will be opposed by those of us who might perceive it as another attempt to run around our hard-earned overlay to exploit our neighborhood for quick cash and profit, commonly known around here as growth, expansion, and improvement at the cost of real progress, human values, and living standards. I believe the Benton Stevens neighborhood community wish to opt out of such a infill travesty. Benton Stevens is our treasure, and we are also invested very much to keep it that way. We'll continue to fight for the values and aesthetics which make living in Benton Stevens worthwhile, not merely the quick cash rewards some seem to covet so very much. Finally, by the way, while you are tasking the Planning and Zoning Commission to reconfigure neighborhoods, why not task yourselves to demand builders, contractors, and their lawyers so seemingly determined to haphazardly deface Columbia with their student barracks to finance their own infrastructure costs? This way, we could find out once and for all how truly dedicated these people are for the real growth, expansion, and improvement in our community of Columbia. Give me real progress over exploitation every time. Thank you.
I appreciate
your work.
Thank you. Anyone else?
My name's John Clark. I live 403 North 9th Street. I attended the pre-council meeting today, and I'm sad, not surprised, but sad to it was a continuation of the effort to basically have a generational opportunity to give the whole store away in Columbia. One of the premises behind a lot of the efforts, we have a lot of infrastructure needs. We have a lot of infrastructure needs in the central city. We have infrastructure needs on our fringes. Focusing on downtown, we have infrastructure needs, but this has been phrased as almost a but-for to have $250 to $300 million of residential development. We don't need residential development. It is derivative development. It is a Ponzi scheme to build your paying for your infrastructure, your jobs, and so forth on just having more and more people. So I agree, and I think Mr. Thomas may have said it, we have real serious problems. But we don't have an emergency to find a way to subsidize, incentivize somehow or another derivative development downtown. The second thing is, of course, absent a coherent long-term assessment of our infrastructure capacity needs looking out 20 years across a number of sectors of growth, it's just not possible to think rationally about what we should do and how we should finance it, and what would be the fair proportionate share for different developments, including the developments on Northeast Columbia as well as downtown, what they should pay for them. I was particularly discouraged by, frankly, Mayor McDavid's performance of the wonderful back-of-the-envelope analysis about how we could find funds in various places to pay for 6.7 mil or so in sewer improvements. I've watched those kinds of things. I used to advise people in construction. Every time I saw that kind of stuff, I knew people were going to lose money. It is not the way to do things. Our city deserves a better way. And there are ways. They're just not immediate. So if we don't need that particular development because it's derivative, we can take the appropriate time to meaningfully plan this. If we somehow or another financed with this and built the big pipe for 6.7 using the equity buy-in fees of the sewer system, which are to buy into the whole system, including the treatment plant, we would just basically be putting ourselves in a bigger and bigger hole. For this reason, and to support a better way of doing this, I'm seriously considering registering as a write-in candidate in the first ward. Thank you.
Thank you. Anyone else? If not, we'll move to council comments.
I'll pass tonight. Just a few. I've been in some discussions with some of my constituents just this last Saturday at office hours having to do with the East Walnut area. We went through the East Walnut discussion and so on with the R3 property. This was a little bit different than that, although they were trying to decide whether to pursue any interests that they have. But they did mention a few things about East Walnut, and I wanted to kind of at least bring them up again, maybe get a little bit of feedback from the staff, one of which was this area now, and in particular, now that there's going to be some development there, not hugely dense, but and that there is some attention because of Roots and Blues and Barbecue and so on, it is a two-lane, kind of reminiscent of Clark Lane, actually. It's a two-lane, unimproved
kind of a residential road, not quite the thoroughfare that Clark Lane is, but it is going to get an increasing amount of traffic, and it already has. It intersects with 63, which already has a considerable amount of traffic going at a reasonably high rate of speed, particularly as it comes down the hill and those folks wait at the stop sign at East Walnut. So at one point or another, we were considering, or at least talked about, a roundabout, which would be hugely expensive, I realize that, but nonetheless, as an option for that intersection, the East Walnut intersection and 63. And some of my constituents also mentioned taking a look, if possible, at some of the speed limits coming down that hill in terms of remedying that situation to make it a safer intersection. So that was one of the issues.
Can I just ask a clarifying question? You know, we put the pedestrian crossing in there, and that's helped greatly because there's a median and the traffic slows down there so people can get in and out. So are you suggesting in addition to
that? Yeah, I'm not suggesting it. It was suggested
to
me.
Just to look at. Okay, yeah. I feel like I go there a lot, and I feel like it's improved greatly with the pedestrian crossing for the cars.
Well, I think it has, but the conversation that I had still thought that there was a significant problem there. And ultimately, if that street is improved, I will press for that if I can, there's going to be an even larger problem because it'll probably attract some more traffic. I don't know. At this point, it was just something that they wanted me to ask and get some information. The other issue is I know I talked to the city manager about the tree board, and I can't quite remember what it was that you said that we should be doing, but we're going to get together at some point and discuss that further. Is that the idea with that?
Heather's going to call and ask for who
that's
you want.
That's what you said
in the meeting. So we'll reach out to you and draw that.
Great. I just wanted to remind myself on that. And one other thing, obviously this comes up every once in a while, but. We did make great progress over the last year or two with Albert Oakland Park and restoring the sign on Albert Oakland Park and I guess that will take some $10,000 or $12,000 to the extent to which something like Stevens Lake Park, a permanent sign, is already in existence. Something like that, I guess, on Blue Ridge Road. I just wanted to know and maybe get a progress report on that kind of thing and see where we are and when we might be considering that or what we would need to do to consider that to move that project along. That's all I had.
I had a couple things. First of all, I wanted to congratulate the True and False Film Festival. There was just so much participation, and it was really, again, a valuable contribution to the city, to the culture, to young people and old people, to give us documentaries that the community can gather and listen to and experience and discuss and think about. And it was also very vast, and they're partnering with the educational institutions and the university and the journalism school to create a large community dialogue on so many different issues, and very entertaining, at least some of them, maybe not all. But it was really a great success, and even with the bad weather, the Missouri Theater was packed Sunday night with weather at zero or below zero. And they had another main venue going on at the same time, Jesse Auditorium, and I wasn't there, so I don't know if it was packed, but they've really grown to an enormous extent. And I also want to thank whoever was responsible. It may be the city, the CID, the business owners, or a whole combination of those, for really doing an excellent job of salting the sidewalks and the crosswalks of the street to make sure that people could get to all the venues. It was very impressive, and I heard really complimentary remarks by so many people who not only live in our community but were visiting our community. So kudos to all those people and all the volunteers, which or at least I think I've heard 1,000 volunteers in the community to make that happen. And second, in pre-council, we were discussing the moving forward of C2 zoning with the consultants and coming forward with some basic modifications on that, and planning or community development director mentioned that they were working on height and parking, but I hope that they're not restricted to that. There's concerns about office, retail, particularly I've heard from people who were involved in the planning of the Avenue of the Columns, and one of the strong recommendations from that planning committee was to have a vibrant corridor with office retail as much as possible on 8th Street. So I guess I'd like some clarification that the consultants are not being restricted to just height and parking. And if so, if they are, then do we need a motion to expand that a little bit?
I think we'll get back to you on that, if that's acceptable. Of course, any direction you'd like to give is welcome.
Pardon?
We'll get back to you on terms of the question if you want to give direction to that effect.
Yeah,
we're open to that.
It was my understanding that the consultants would look at the charrette and the various recommendations and then make some suggestions with best practices, and that they weren't restricted only to height and parking. Nope. So we gave them some leeway in terms of.
Barbara, I think this wasn't only restricted to the consultant, which is very valuable, and I agree with your direction. But I mean, we actually got several recommendations from some of the boards and commissions in terms of this whole discussion before it was deferred. Actually,
right. So, and that the consultants would were subsequently given those recommendations from those committees and looking at them. And then the last follow-up thing is. I read in the newspaper about IBM and cutting of staff, and there was some figures in the newspaper that you know, their goal was 800 employees, and that by December 2012 there were 544. Earlier in last year, I asked if they were on track, and I was told they were generally, so I'd like an update on that, and to make sure. I know they received a certain amount of money based on the employees, so just to make sure that is all on track, to get an update on all of that.
Let me just add that was a state requirement, and the state is, it's up to them to monitor that. And I think the number was 600 was the minimum they had to achieve. Was it the first to last year?
I know that it's prorated based on how many.
Yeah.
Right. But the state is, the Department of Economic Development, the state level is monitoring.
Right.
I think they didn't reach 600 at some point, but I'm not sure.
Well, if we could maybe, I think, would a report from the Department of Economic Development.
Just a report. I think, the community is interested.
We'll compile that and deliver it via report.
Ian?
Yeah, I have a couple of things. First of all, while in general I agree with John Clark's comments that with regard to downtown development, it's really important that we take a step back and make sure that we have good, strong policies in place for the long term to make sure that we're not reeling into more of these kind of crises. But there's one particular development that I feel may have been badly treated, and I'm a little worried about the credibility of the city and the information that's been received by Collegiate Housing Partners. It's certainly been my impression that, from things that staff have said, that that project had the go-ahead, had enough capacity on all of the utilities, and on the document tonight, it does not have sewer capacity, and they've gone ahead and financed the whole project, demolished, bought the property, demolished buildings. They want to start developing, start building on April the 1st in order to be ready to open in August. So I'm a little concerned about how the communications has gone with that particular developer, and I hope we can find a way to allow them to proceed. I'm a particular fan of that project because they have taken a very progressive view on transportation provisions for their residents. They've built the minimum required by us number of parking spaces. They're going to have a car share program on site. They're going to have a bike share program on site. They're going to have 90 bike parking spaces. They've committed to buying at least 100 Columbia Transit bus passes every year if there is uptake for those. So my view, and not this is not necessarily shared by everybody, is that they are the kind of downtown residential development that is consistent with the densification, the growth, and the shift in transportation mode that, in my view, we're going to need. So that transitions me to the second point, which under our discussion of some rapid fire analysis and possible revisions on C2 zoning with regard to building height and parking, I'm particularly interested in the discussion about parking requirements. At the moment, we have minimum parking requirements. We tell development that they have to build at least a certain number of spaces. For example, American Campus Communities, I think is the full name, ACC, are in their proposed development, which is held up on electrical and sewer and maybe water right now, but nevertheless, over 700, a little over 700 spaces. They are required by our ordinances to put in at least 490 vehicle spaces. Personally, I think that's the wrong direction. It's a really interesting issue, is this. We have increased, you know, development pressure and densification downtown, and it sends two different groups of people in kind of two diverging directions as to what we should do. A lot of people look at this and say we really have to provide and force them to provide more parking. And others, and I'm in the second set, feel that we have to think about a whole shift, a cultural shift in the way we view transportation in a urban, compact, livable, walkable, transit-oriented downtown development, and we have to really go the other way. My feeling is that if we continue to think in terms of most residents, most individuals having their own privately owned vehicle in the downtown area, and most people coming in and out of downtown doing so in their own privately owned vehicle, we're going to have a continual cycle of needing to construct more and more parking and then needing to widen our arterials coming in and out of downtown more and more, and we will lose the very ambience that we want to have downtown. So as we get into a conversation about downtown zoning and parking, I will push for a maximum parking requirement rather than a minimum, or at the very least to remove the minimum requirements so that developers are not forced to build more parking. When they have a vision and a marketing plan, and it's not just collegiate housing, because Opus, they were going to be in a similar situation. They want to build very minimal on-site parking and promote alternative modes of transportation to their residents. We don't want to be forcing those kind of developers to essentially forsake what I think are good progressive ideas. All right, I'm done.
If I may, just throw up one thing on the CHP development. There is a letter from our sewer folks to them that is you cannot be confused about it. It's extremely clear about the limitations of the sewer there. So we'll share that with everyone so you have a better sense. I don't want you to feel like there was any misleading or any green lighting. It's quite the opposite. However, that said, you're right. They've been a fantastic developer to date. They've been extremely responsive to every concern by the council and the community. You remember they were going to tear down the Niedermeyer, and they stepped back from that and helped us find Nakhle Osmar, who saved it, and then have done this, and I think a very high-quality plan. So we're you know, as a staff, trying to find, navigate that path, but it was never unclear about the sewer, and I'll share that letter with you.
Anyone else?
I'll pass.
Meeting is adjourned at 8:29.
What am I going to do?